Where are we? Gallery. Hello, darling people. Karen, Kit, Ken, Felicity, Siv again, Deb, Yvette, and Deb and Kate, and Peter and Jennifer, and LT. What's LT? Sounds like my character. Okay, we're all here. I'm so used to Zooms. People there, you know, people now. Okay. So we're going to talk about continue on from yesterday, right?
The next immeasurable. The next exciting chapter.
So we think first, let's take a little prayer to start. We're going to do this little hour together, or how many minutes is left? Think and contemplate. And if there's even one, I would say if there's even 1% of it that's useful, that's good enough. 1% is good enough, you know. Here is advice, that's the idea. So it's advice coming from Buddhism, and it's about how to develop our amazing potential. That's really the Buddhist point. For our sake and the sake of others. Okay. I'm going to sing a little prayer in Tibetan. It sort of says that. Sangye charam toke chognam la ran chubadu jagni kyapsu chi. Tagi chonyen gipe sonam ki. Drola penche sangye drupa shok. Sangye charam toke chognam la ran chubadu jagni kyapsu chi. Tagi chonyen gipe sonam ki. Drola penche sangye drupa shok. Sangye charam toke chognam la ran chubadu jagni kyapsu chi. Tagi chanyan gi personan ki drola penche sangye drupa shok. So it's four immeasurables, so many, so sweet, you know, phrase, immeasurable thoughts. And it's from the compassion, these two meanings, wisdom and compassion. All the nuts and bolts of being like internally doing the work of sorting yourself out and becoming less neurotic and less miserable and more condensed, more contented, more fulfilled. That's kind of the wisdom wing. And then on the basis of that, you realize my people are all in the same boat. How can I help others? Compassion wing. So this four immeasurable thoughts, this aspiration, you know, these really powerful aspirations of these that we're trying to cultivate. So the beginnings of wanting to cultivate this equanimity, love and compassion, and this fourth one that can be free of suffering. Something like that. Totally free of or totally not parted from the result of all this hard work. So the background, just for a second, it's good to remember, the background of this is Buddha's view, his own observation, his own findings, his own creator, he didn't make it all up. No such idea in Buddhism. That we've all got this extraordinary potential. First of all, to be content and fulfilled and clear and wise in ourselves. And then on the basis of that, connecting with others and realizing we're all in the same boat. And this kind of brave attitude, this courageous attitude to want to be of benefit to others. It's a bit like, you know, you become, everybody in the universe becomes your child, like you're the mum, you know, and you have this powerful sense of responsibility. Of course, the wisdom will give you the ability to know how to help others. You know, I think people often like a spiritual path because it seems to be about compassion and goodness and kindness, helping others. But this whole idea here that Buddha's idea is very clear, I think it's obvious. If you can't, you know, if you're miserable and depressed and anxious and worried and angry and despairing, how can you help even a fly? You can't see past your own nose. So you've got to kind of make yourself happy first, then you can make other people happy. It's kind of obvious. The wisdom wing. You know, you can have so much compassion, let's say, for the world, you know, like let's say you're already obese and unhealthy. You can have enormous compassion. What good is a compassion if you don't know how to help them? You've got to sort out what nutrition is first, put yourself together, then you can help others. That's the whole idea. Makes such sense. So yesterday we contemplated the first of these four immeasurable thoughts. So let me say more first. It's a little prayer we can do. Because the idea in Buddhism is every thought we have counts. Nothing goes astray. Which is quite surprising because we think thoughts don't matter. Thought produces the person we become. So all of the prayers in Buddhism are like these aspirations. May this happen. May that happen. So the first one is may. How wonderful it would be all sentient beings could abide in equanimity. This very specific state of mind. or you know, being free of attachment, anger, and indifference. Second one is how wonderful it would be. If all sentient beings could be free of suffering and its causes. And the next one is how wonderful it would be if all sentient beings could have happiness and its causes. And then the fourth one is how wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were never parted from higher rebirths and liberation's excellent bliss. So, of course, this fourth one, clearly, you know, it's kind of Buddhist aspiration. You wouldn't say that as a Christian. You wouldn't say that as a philosophical materialist that's pointing to Buddha's view, you know. That there are these trillions of consciousnesses pervading the universe and they come from before and will carry on later. And that this, and the other extra component here, which is the unique view of Buddha, everything we think, do and say is the process that produces the person we become. There's no view of creator in the world. We create ourselves. We bring ourselves with us from the past, and whatever we do, same thing, now produces the future. We're the boss. We create ourselves, if you like. It's quite an interesting concept. It's behind all this. So this aspirations. So if one said, one has this prayer, it's this on this compassion wing, and it's this attitude, this brave attitude, you know, because the second, and there's extra little lines on each of those four when you extend it. May they abide so, you would say. May they have, you know, may they be free. May they have love. May they have happiness. And then the next little line says, I will make this happen. That really indicates this brave attitude of the body, of the person who's accomplished these levels of compassion and love, or what we're trying to accomplish. So the thing to remember first, I said it now, and I want to say it again, because I think we don't think this way. If we think of prayers, when I was a Catholic, one said prayers, but we think we're praying to somebody and requesting something. And that's okay. It's fine to do that. And there's some aspect of that in Buddhism. But many of our so-called prayers are these, are thoughts, are sort of announcing your thoughts, announcing your wishes. Ramazoba says everything exists on the tip of the wish, the thought. And so it's a seed in the mind. It programs the mind. So it's marvelous just from that point of view, having these brave thoughts, you know, I will make this happen. So then what we'll do under the second line today, love, we did equanimity yesterday. So what is love? So everybody says that everybody on the planet has this word. Well, it's crucial to understand the Buddhist perspective that we've got neurotic, deluded, ridiculous, unhappy, I-based, self-centered, miserable states of mind that break our hearts and cause us to harm others. And then we have positive, virtuous, appropriate, valid, useful, productive states of mind that make us happy and help us help others. So the essence of these really are these compassion and love. Compassion and love, Wilson talks about that. Compassion and love. So love, bare bones, is a thought, starting thought, may be happy. It's a delight in someone else's happy. It's necessarily altruistic. Yeah. It's a connection with others. So the key function of the first lot, the unhappy states of mind, is this self, they're utterly self-based. They're miserable. They're unhappy. They don't feel guilty. They make us miserable. They're totally eye-based. We can't see past our own nose. And they're fear-based, which is fascinating. They're driven by kind of fear and anxiety. It's kind of interesting. Or there's an analysis that explains it in the literature, but we can't go into that now. But these positive ones, they're spacious. You know very well if you know a person who's not so attached and angry and jealous and anxious and depressed, you can see immediately they're more happy and spacious and content and fulfilled and loving and compassionate. I think we can see it in ourselves. There's a real distinction between these two. We don't make this distinction in modern psychology at all. But this is a defining characteristic in Buddhist psychology. And it's a revelation when we can understand and see it in ourselves. So, of course, the Buddha's idea is we can rid the mind eventually, utterly, of all the rubbish ones and fully develop all the others, which is an interesting idea. So, really, in these thoughts on the compassion, we're trying to cover this brave attitude. I will make it happen. So I don't know. We did the meditation yesterday because you can do that with equanimity. How do you do a meditation on love? You've never done it. What would you do? How would you spend 45 minutes on love? How would you lead a guided meditation?
I would think of all the things people need and imagine offering it to them.
Oh, I see. I've never thought of that. I do other ones.
Oh, do you?
I don't think I've ever done one, 45 minutes.
Well, I mean, I'd start with crochet and I'd end up with, you know, crochet. offering crochet to people. And then I'd end up with offering, you know, so, okay. Everlasting okay. Happiness.
No, there's a hand there. What's that?
Oh,
I just want to cut a power line that came down with a lady holding it one side and a man holding it the other side. So it'd be great to do something to help them there. Then I drove past a guy lying on the road having a major event with police and ambulance going,
oh my God. Like
And of course, my ego wanted to get here on to
yeah. That's so interesting. I don't know what you expect. If you expect to put us in here today, if you expect 45 minutes of silent meditation, you'd be very disappointed.
No.
So I do think how to tolerate this one. It makes me do these things. I've got to do it with you serious. I just have to do what I feel like. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, I think with the collective karmas coalescing to see what happens.
See what happens. Okay, I think what I would rather talk about is distinguish between attachment and love that
good.
Tells us what love is.
Fantastic.
We don't know this. They're like chalk and cheese. You can't say that in America. No one knows what you're talking about. It's completely popping in Australia, you know. I've never heard like talk and cheese. Never heard that before. It's a good one. Yeah. So let's look at this. This is now I'm going to yes. Now I know what to say. Okay. So listen. So let's pretend I'm in love with Eddie. Sorry, Eddie, to be embarrassing Eddie. Let's pretend I'm in love with Eddie. It's a really good example. This is how we can see the difference. You know, it's treat it like a meditation. I said yesterday, I remember in the Buddhism, the word to meditate means to familiarize, the verb to become familiar with. Which is quite surprising. We have these other cosmic ideas of it. So one approach to meditation, there are some where you are simply focusing, no conceptual thoughts, you train to focus, but you're utilizing that training to focus to do clear kind of analysis. So we're having an analytical meditation. So let's look at the difference between attachment and love. They're utterly, profoundly, and completely and totally different, but we literally would not know the difference. We literally, they're like together in a big soup. But the Buddha's whole point is the neurotic states of mind make us miserable and cause us to harm others. And the positive states of mind make us happy and cause us to make others happy. So let's look at the difference, because it is a revelation. So I'm in love with Eddie, let's say. So the attachment part is coming from here, comes from this sense of not having enough, not being enough. This is crucial. So there's this enormous emotional hunger to find something out there such that when I get it, I'm convinced I'll get happy, I'll be satisfied. So here we dump it, we especially dump it on people. And that's where love and attachment can be really seen coming together. You don't always talk about, you don't say, you don't have love for chocolate cake. We say that, but love is for a sentient being. Love is for someone to be happy. This is the meaning in Buddhism. So there I say, what is it? What I'm in love with, 90% of that's attachment. This excitement, this energy, this feeling you've found this amazing being who totally looks divine to you. So all these, so the function of the attachment is this emotional hunger coming from not having enough, not being enough, aching, separate, bereft, hungrily looking for something. And then you find this person. And then, you know, then the next step is to get them. Manipulate to get them. And then the crucial job of attachment is to, it's an over-exaggeration based on this emotional hunger, it's an embellishing of his deliciousness. An embellishing, it exaggerates his deliciousness. So, of course, it triggers very delicious feelings. And this is another kettle of fish altogether. Feelings, happy feelings is not attachment and is not love. It's another whole part of our mind. So, It energizes incredibly vicious feelings, which of course is what we want. So along with that, Our saving grace is love. So if there's any love, that means it's an altruistic thought. It wants him to be happy. You'll even go to the point of making him happy if you can. You want to do that. That's our saving grace, and that comes with compassion, that'll come with patience, that'll come with forgiveness, that'll come with kind of generosity, all the positive qualities. We recognize that. We can see in that relationship, if there's more attachment than love, then that's when you're in serious trouble. So the attachment exaggerates his deliciousness. But it's kind of needy and neurotic and manipulative. If you mainly had attachments, this is a bit horrible here. If we mainly had attachments, but not much love, we'd be like a little vampire, you know? You'd be a psychopath. That's what a psychopath is. Person who's got mainly delusions and is intensely suffering, totally self-centered. You know, no virtue, can't access their virtue. Our virtues are our saving grace. So at the moment, it is easy, talked this up yesterday. It is easy to want Eddie to be happy if I'm attached to him. I mean, totally, I've got a massive vested interest. It's got strings attached, as they would say. As long as ever says, this love we have is unstable. It's still love, better than nothing. But it's contingent upon him fulfilling my attachment's needs. So it's quite heavy, really. I'm prepared to love him, but he's got to deserve it. So we don't notice all this. We don't notice it seems so pure when we love the boyfriend. But it's contingent upon him fulfilling my needs because we know what happens. The millisecond he's mean, the millisecond he doesn't fulfill my attachment's needs, the love turns off like a tap. Even for 5 minutes, and then you turn it on again because it's still okay. So it's very fragile, the love we have now. This virtuous wish that he be happy. We have this for our babies, for the boyfriend, our friends. But of course, as soon as they start not to fulfill our needs, not to fulfill my emotional hunger's needs, my attachment's needs, then the love stops. Look at the world. So we can make this distinction. It's quite sobering. And of course, we have to then be able to distinguish the difference in our minds. It's huge. So of course, the idea here is, as we talked yesterday with equanimity, equanimity, like I said yesterday, is that if we're trying to first stabilize our mind in relation to the outside world, sentient beings. And as far as this view is concerned, there's only three categories of them. There are those who are our friends, who are the objects of our attachment. There are those who are a so-called enemy, we might use that word, but as the object of our aversion. And those who are for whom we're indifferent, they're the strangers. 99.9% of them. So the friends are the only ones we have love and compassion for. And this is the world. You know, you have my people. And they're the ones you're attached to. Who you see as gorgeous. And as long as they keep fulfilling my needs, I'm prepared to keep wanting them to be happy. It sounds brutal, but it's like that. It's like that. And this is why it's enormously hard if Eddie gives me up. You know, chucks me out and moves in Miffy. I mean, look at the devastation, look at the pain, the anger, the resentment, the bitterness. It can make people completely insane. The delusions will run rampant. And the fundamental basis of that suffering is the craving, the attachment, the neediness, the default mode, deep in the bones of our being, hungrily, you know, expecting Eddie to fulfill my needs. Look at yourself centered. Quite shocking to the ears. We don't think this in the West. We just think it's a part of a normal person. But the Buddha says it's the cause of our suffering. It's the basis of all the other neuroses. And then we can get rid of them. This is what's amazing. We can get rid of them. Shocking, maybe. And and love and compassion and wisdom and the good ones, they are at the core of our being. They can be developed limitlessly. So in these meditations, in the compassion wing, we're trying to proactively cultivate those. In the wisdom wing, we're trying to lessen the neuroses. In the compassion wing, we're trying to still continue to work on the neuroses, but proactively try to grow the virtues, these brave, amazing attitudes of love and compassion. And not, but that's the point now. Based on equanimity that we did yesterday, we've got to go beyond those three labels. Equanimity is this heartfelt recognition. The friend, enemy, stranger. Are equal to each other from one point of view. They each want to be happy, and they each don't want suffering. So we're trying to develop love for each one, maybe happy, and compassion for each one, maybe not suffer, not because you make me happy, but because you want to be happy. That's the shift in the logic. Equanimity is a start upon a basis of which you then begin to develop love and compassion. There's a series of techniques that lead each to the other. You know, the foundation is this equanimity one. So distinguishing between attachment and love is pretty intense, because they just come automatically at the moment. They come together in like one flavor. You know, so to distinguish is really difficult. To hear the conceptual stories deep in our bones that inform these emotions we have. So in the compassion room, we're trying to develop this love and compassion for all beings, not because they make me happy, but because they want to be happy, want to be free of suffering, not because they had that for me, but because they want that. So it's getting yourself out of the equation. That's the key thing. And this is enormously difficult. Even if we're nice people, we can see we always have our people. There are those we don't, whose politics we don't like, whose music we don't like, who are the harmers. You know, they're kind of over there. And then the 99.9%, we don't even notice them. This is a stranger. So these three labels are totally lie-based. If I said yesterday, we should be embarrassed. So okay, I'll see what I can do, what Vicky said. May have. So then the wanting others to be happy, the most simple level, the simplest level is may they have what they need, you know. The more powerful one is may they, of course, develop their own virtue and rid their mind of their own rubbish, which is the basis for them for stable happiness. So before we do a little bit one maybe start to think about what we suggested. Let's just again look. Let's just look at a bit more. So we've got attachment, I-based, automatic, in the bones of our being, default mode, at the level of assumption. Hard to recognize. And then we have this want to cultivate this, may you be happy, may others be happy. So I think it's good to talk about what happiness is. This is a massively important one, frankly. In Buddhism, again, it's got this very specific definition. So I'll talk a bit more about this. We still have plenty of time rather than do a little guided visualization, I promise. So what is happiness? What is suffering? Well, I think at the moment, the way the Buddhist approach certainly is, we totally all believe that somehow happiness comes from eddy. My happiness comes from eddy. And it seems like that. If I'm in love with Eddie, he looks divine and he smiles at me like I'm an angel. And we just faint with pleasure. You can't believe someone's looking at you as if you're so divine, you know. So it definitely triggers really pleasant, really joyful feelings. So happiness in Buddhism is not an object. It's not even directly mainly caused by contact with the cake or Eddie, but we so conflate those. You know, when I say to you, what? Or you tell me, Ravina, why are you happy? Tell me about your happiness. And I'll describe Eddie as if he's the actual kind of, he's injected happiness into me somehow. Certainly, I believe he's the main cause of my happiness. That's why I have to keep holding on to him. And I really believe that somehow, equally, I think he's also the happiness. If you say, tell me about your happiness, I'll describe the object. We remember the object, you remember the event, you remember the cake, you remember the person. Well, the Buddha's view is very precise, you know. You've got this, lots of different states of mind, the negative, neurotic, ridiculous ones, the positive, virtuous ones, and these other lot that have neither, they're not, they haven't got that kind of character. So one of these is simply called feeling, and it's bare bones. And you only got three kinds of them, happy ones, unhappy ones, and neutral ones. Let's forget the neutral. Don't worry about that. We've either got pleasant ones or happy ones, a happy feeling, a pleasant feeling, a joyful feeling, a blissful feeling, an ecstatic feeling. I mean, I'm waiting for them. I haven't had them yet. The levels of pleasant feelings. And then you've got unpleasant feelings, all the way from the mildest unpleasant feeling when you stub your toe to the most intense, unbearable agony. These are states of mind. The physical body itself is not happy feelings or suffering feelings. This is a curious concept. It's the mind. So we have sensory consciousness, the sensory, which is connected to the body, but it's the mind. Sensory consciousness is the mind. And then we have mental consciousness. They experience pleasant and unpleasant feelings. So the Buddha's idea is we've got the potential to be extraordinarily happy all the time, which sounds a bit strange to us. And the cause of it are these virtuous positive thoughts, a build-up, the practice, the development of positive actions, positive thoughts that accumulate and ripen as happiness. And then the negative states of mind, the negative actions accumulate and ripen as unhappy feelings. This is the meaning of karma. It's not moralistic, it's not judgment, not reward, not punishment. There's no punisher and rewarder in Buddhism. It's a natural process. We produce these ourselves, inside ourselves, by what we think and do and say. So wanting others to have happy feelings, to have happiness, at the most simple level, will be to have a happy, to have environments that suit them, people who are friendly, food that's tasty. These are the outside objects. So we wish those for others. But eventually we're wishing for others that they, develop this ability, this natural potential for joy, which the Buddha says we are all capable of, that comes along with love and compassion and goodness and kindness. And these are stable within it. These are our true nature. Love and compassion and the virtuous states of mind are our true nature. When we fully develop them and rid the mind of all the other rubbish, then the bonus is happy feelings. The bonus is to be joyful. But it's not contingent upon external things. And that's quite shocking to us, because that's the absolute method we all use. To find we want, initially, the happiness that comes from contact with delicious food and pleasant friends, nothing wrong, it's happy feelings. But finally, the happiness we want, the joy we want, this is the Buddha's analysis, is that our own mind, the result of our own hard practice, the practice of virtue and goodness. This is the way they're talking Buddhism. It's not like a gift that someone gives you. It's a natural consequence of practicing virtue and goodness. So we want that for everybody. We want that. And that's the last one where it says, may they never be parted from liberation's excellent bliss. Liberation or nirvana is when you've cut the root of all the rubbish and you've only got the goodness left. May they finally have that level of happiness. the cessation of suffering this causes, they call, which is the liberation, and it's, in other words, the mind fully developed in virtue and joy. It sounds so weird to us to talk like this. It's not what we talk in the West, but this is what we do. So we want that for people. So maybe just do a little more time to what you say. Never done it before. So let's just think of, we'll do continue from yesterday. Think of a friend, an enemy, and a stranger, okay? Think of a friend, an enemy, and a stranger. Person to the left, your beloved. Person in front of you, is mean to you, harmful to you, so-called enemy, object of your aversion. And a person to the right, a stranger. Maybe someone whose face you've not seen, who's here today, you don't know anything about them, whose face you can put there. A beloved to the left, a meanie one in the middle, and a stranger to the right. Just imagine. So first establish this truth. the scientific truth actually was scientists. The three of them, whom at the moment we are seeing through the lenses of our neuroses, a nice one, ugly one, boring one. There's no objective reality in that. So get yourself out of the equation and try and see these three people as separate from you. Don't see them through the lenses of your own attachment to them. Separate, three individual people. So clearly see, you know, if you're in their shoes, it's clear. One could be a saint and one really could be a monster. That's not the issue here. See them as three separate people. And you know from yourself that each of them, every minute, is driven by this wish, this yearning, this wish to only have happy feelings. Nobody wants unhappy feelings. It's so clear. Get this really clear in your mind. Recognize this. They're equal from that one point of view. Thousands of others, but this is the one we want to have. That's equanimity, recognizing that. That each one has happy feelings. You know yourself. You only want happy feelings. You don't want unhappy ones. We try to avoid those. They're the same. That's equanimity. See that. Understand that logically. It's not an emotional thing. It's not kind of moralistic. See it. It's really clear. Trouble is, as soon as it's the ex-boyfriend who really did harm you, and you're trying to see that he just wants to be happy, first instinct is to think he doesn't deserve to be happy. That's not the issue here. That's not the point. It's the fact that it's just every being in the universe is driven by this. Wish to be happy. Wish not to suffer. Recognize this. Try to see this. Know this to be true. So now, when you look at your beloved, we're driven automatically to want to make them happy. We are so happy to make them happy. We can't wait to make them happy. So easy, isn't it? So look at your ex-boyfriend or your mean, whoever the mean person is. And mainly what we see is what they've done wrong to us. So we paint them with the brush of aversion or anger or ugly, you know. That might be true, but we don't want to see that part here. So imagine wanting your friend. And when you see them smile, you're so happy for them. That's what love is. I'm happy when they're happy. So now your ex-boyfriend, this is where it's so bitter and cruel, it's not fair, but it's true. He wants to be happy. Yes, he's neurotic. Yes, he lied to you. Yes, he cheated on you. He did. But what drove it? His wish to be happy. She was far more pretty and cuter, and she, you know, dragged him by the nose and he left you. So what drove him to even do that dumb action to hurt you was because he thought it would make him happy. He wants to be happy. But he's just so self-centered he couldn't see that what he was doing was causing you to suffer. So want him to know he wants to be happy and want it for him. May you be happy. Of course, underneath this and later, you then have the thought, may he find the method to make himself happy. And that means to practice virtue and not cheat on people. But the fundamental drive in him. I mean, think of anybody there. We always love to hate the politicians. When I was living in America, Mr. Trump loomed large in the lives of Americans, you know. So think, may Mr. Trump be happy? Meaning, I want him to be happy. I really want him to have happy feelings. I want him to be happy. Want him to be happy, just like your friend. May you be happy. May you have pleasant feelings. May you find joy. Joy is a nicer word for pleasant feelings, that's all. And then imagine if he is happy, you see him smiling, even if he's deluded, be happy for him. Be happy for him. Like for your friend, say it's your child, and they find a good job or a good husband or a good house, you're over the moon for them. You're so pleased, you know. Now look at Mr. Trump. He's got this gorgeous house in Palm Beach or somewhere in Florida. Be so happy for him. I'm so pleased Mr. Trump's got a beautiful bathroom with gold taps, a big bedroom, lovely places, lovely gardens, and a view of the beach. I'm so happy for him. Be happy for him. Be glad for him. That's love. Not discussing whether he cheated to get the house. That's not the discussion. It's about these lovely things. I'm happy for him. I'm pleased for him. May he be happy. Now your stranger is just so boring, you can't even look at them. The world is full of strangers. 99.999% of the universe are strangers to us. And that means, so then why we have attachment for the beloveds is because they're close up front and they proactively do things to make me happy. So we have massive vested interest in their being happy. While we don't want the enemy to be happy, we have to practice it. It's because they've done mean things to us and they don't deserve to be happy. But the stranger's done neither. They've neither harmed us nor helped us. That's what the stranger is. So literally indifference is there. And that's quite inert. It's hard to get past that. It's like a deep, can't be bothered. You know? At least attachment and anger more are kind of volatile. The indifference is just totally bored. So I'm a boring person walking down the street, you know. Imagine them as well. Even finding one nice meal, a nice cup of tea, I'm happy for them. And a good thing happens to strangers. You know, like countries and names you can't even say, full of strangers. And you hear that something pleasant happened. Conjure them, imagine it, be happy for it. See them as, and as soon as you do that, they become human to you. Otherwise, it is vague, distant nothings. You want them to be happy. See them being happy. See a stranger laughing. Be happy for that person. Be pleased, even for a moment, they had pleasant feelings. So this takes effort, this is the point. It's easy to love our beloveds. It's hard. It's harder to love enemies than strangers even. So you have to go past your comfort zone. You have to go past your attachment and say the words. In the beginning, it's kind of not so exciting, but like anything, you train. The love is being happy when others are happy. Simple level. Want, and then wanting them to be happy. And as we progress, and go beyond this one, have more equanimity. You know, you still have your beloved at home. Having equanimity doesn't mean you have to then, you might as well bring the stranger into the house and chuck out your lover. No, you still keep your ones you've got a close connection to, but you extend your love and compassion to include the others, not just keep it for the beloveds. It means training. All these are training, you know. These are conceptual, these are intellectual meditations. You're training your mind to think differently. Familiarizing your mind with new ways of seeing things. This is a major part of what we're trying to do. And then like anything, it gets habitual. You familiarize yourself with these new thoughts. And then it becomes a habit. And then it becomes easy. Tibetans have a lovely way of saying, practice makes perfect. They say, nothing ever gets more difficult with practice. And the thing is, with these types of meditations, you're using logic. to argue with ego's absurd misconception. It's not just wishy-washy, gooey feelings. You're using logic, using your virtue and your wisdom thoughts to argue with the irrational self-centered thoughts of attachment, anger, indifference, etc. So you've got to stretch yourself. Okay, maybe your hubby left you last week after 45 years. It's a bit much to ask, expect to do it immediately, but slowly, slowly. May he be happy. One of the key thing here that I think we miss is that who do you think is the beneficiary of these very thoughts we're trying to have? We are the beneficiary. This is to benefit our mind. This is training our mind to see things differently. Therefore, it causes us to become more happy, fulfilled, content, joyful. Don't ever underestimate that. Don't ever think that's selfish. These are practices to help us develop our mind in loving thoughts and compassionate thoughts. And then, of course, your body and speech will carry it out in daily life and will do the actions. It's got to start with a thought. Everything exists on the tip of the wish, the thought. So it's reprogramming your mind. That's what being a Buddhist really is. He's a cognitive therapist. Just to see the logic of these things, not force yourself to feel something irrational, to see the logic of it. So if we have lots of attachment from one person, intense attachment, overwhelming attachment, it tends to mean we have lots of indifference and lots of aversion for all the others. That makes us lonely. Like if you're really attached to one person, you know, and you walk into a room of people, like a party, and you scan the room in 1 second looking for that person. If they're not there, everyone looks so boring and ugly, you just want to walk out. Because there's so much attachment for that one. It causes indifference and aversion to the others. So we can only be the beneficiary. Dalai Lama says when he's with anybody, he sees him as his best friend. That's why he's always a happy guy, you know? He's always joyful. Because when you're really attached to one person, you're so lonely. And they're not, you know, stuck to you. So we are the beneficiaries of these thoughts. It's training our mind first. Then we extend with our behavior and actually begin to help others. So attachment is this neurotic, eye-based, fear-based, coming from a feeling of not being enough, being a half a person. So you've got to fill yourself up. So you glom it onto the objects and the people out there, which exaggerates their deliciousness and then exaggerates our expectation and demand that they then make me happy and then cause us to be devastated when they let us down. So it's like a nightmare. So we try, and then we have love for those. We extend the love to the ugly ones and all the strangers. And then you, as a result, you are more happy. No question about it. As Dalai Lama said, if you want to help others, practice compassion. If you want to help yourself, practice compassion. Including love and all the rest. But the thing is, if we just think of love and compassion, which we do, as feelings, as kind of like emotions, it's impossible to grow it. How can you force yourself to be weeping with affection for somebody you've never met? It's impossible to think of it at that level. That's why you've got to realize all these emotions, which are body-based, if you drill down inside yourself, you're going to see that these emotions are just like the physical expression of conceptual thoughts deep in your bones. So attachment is I need, I want, desperate, frantic. Love is may you and may I get happy. And love is may you be happy. And practicing, I'm happy when you're happy. Start with the words and slowly the affectionate feelings follow. Compassion is saying, may you not suffer. And then slowly it becomes genuine. You practice the thoughts and then they become automatic. That's the key thing in Buddhist psychology. And with enough developing of may you be happy, eventually affection comes on top. The physical feelings of it, the genuine feelings that we talk about, that'll come. Starts with the thoughts. Starts with the thoughts. We're trying to reconfigure all the conceptual stories in our head, basically. That's what you're doing as a Buddhist, actually. Reprogramming your mind, writing new scripts, literally, truly, not kidding. Start with the thoughts, and then the feelings grow, emotions grow, genuine love, genuine compassion, to the point where it's so stable, it's become your new habit. It's possible. Have confidence in the process, but never forget that you are the beneficiary of this process. Then you can act upon on others. You've got to know that you are the beneficiary. Don't feel ashamed of that. Don't feel that's bad. No, it's not. You want to make others happy? Practice love and compassion. You want to make yourself happy? Practice love and compassion. So logical. That'll do. I didn't do what Wiffy said, I don't think, but was that good enough?
It was good enough.
All right, people. Now questions. Come on. Ask me questions. Yes. Mike?
I've got a question.
Okay, come on.
Thanks, Alicia.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
And then also, so has Sid got a question.
My question is trying to figure out the levels of feeling. So, for instance, when Lama Zogu Rinpoche was going to be coming here, how I felt was just dread because I was just thinking about all the organising.
Yes,
but how I thought was how fantastic the very, very best thing. So what counts and how do you... Because people say, oh, well, what's your gut feeling? Well, my gut feeling's rubbish, so I just ignore it.
No, I see it. No, I feel like that. I suppose that when you're having a party for your birthday, you're so excited about a party, you invite all your beloved friends. Unless you've got servants all around the block, you're going to have to do the damn work. By the time you get to the party, you're so exhausted you won't even enjoy it because the anxiety and the fear and the panic of doing the hard work. And I suppose...
Well, I don't have parties.
Same thing. So we have to, I don't know what to say about that. You know, what to say is the dread of the hard work. Yeah.
So does that really go the, I mean, what's...
Well,
what's
that's coming from attachment. Because attachment wants to be comfortable. We want to sit with our feet up and then eat popcorn and watch telly and relax. We want to be in our comfort zone. So if it's anxious like that, that's because of attachment. Always the suffering because of attachment. If there's suffering, it's because of attachment. It sounds shocking, but it's because of all the hard work and the stress and the anxiety. That's because of attachment.
Hmm.
So there you go.
Yeah.
So don't believe it. It's such a load of rubbish. Yeah. And then they say to the bodhisattvas, they're so enthusiastic. They're so perky and happy, no matter what happens. And every problem is grist for the mill. So they greet it so happily.
How do they do that, though?
Practicing seeing it as good. Start with a thought. Just the same as what I said about the enemy. So you're dreading the hard work and all the stay up night and then the anxiety and the sense of responsibility which we all have that everything goes wrong, it's all your fault, you haven't killed yourself. I mean, that's attachment. So learning to hear the story of attachment and the anxiety and argue with it. Like really argue with the thoughts. Argue with them. No, they have no basis. They're real. You've got them. But argue with it. That's the point, surely. It's being our own therapist. Meanwhile, keep learning the good side, the good thing. Remember the fun of the part. Remember, I think that has to be the only way. You don't want to have, you know, if any, you know, I mean, the person leaves you, you're full of pain, full of hurt, full of anguish, full of resentment. Okay, swim in it for a while, have a week, go to sleep, take a few pills, it's all right. Eventually, you've got to unpack your mind. And I give those thoughts. That's it. Isn't that practice every day? You look puzzled. You know it's right. Of course you know it's right. Are we understanding? You don't look down. You look down.
I know, because I'm just wondering when, so after the party, then I can feel really happy about it. But is there a time where you can feel happy?
Yes, whilst you don't have attachments.
Right.
This is the thing we have to, it sounds so odd, we don't have this analysis in the West. Attachment is this neurotic, frantic, little juggling layer that only can handle everything comfy and lovely. So it has a panic attack when things go wrong. You understand, it's a panic attack when things go wrong. Also because it's your party and it's your event and, you know, you're going to have egg on your face when things go wrong. So we're mortified. All of it's because of attachment. So you have to argue with it. So if you're a really happy person who doesn't have many delusions, you'd enjoy the process as well as the party. You wouldn't worry about it. We have to know that's true. That even knowing that's possible is encouraging. Surely. No? What do you think? Someone behind you first, the other woman. So you first, then you second. Okay, thank you, guys. Anybody here? Sibby's got a question.
Yeah.
The whole point of being a Buddhist is they say, they talk about how we have to learn to know what to cultivate, what to abandon, and what to develop. The bottom line in Buddhism, are you listening before you ask the question? The bottom line, we have to learn to distinguish in our mind between the neurotic, deluded, eye-based, fear-based, ridiculous conceptual stories and the valid, reasonable, virtuous conceptual stories. That's the job of being a Buddhist. Everything else you do supports that job. If you're doing everything else but not that one, you just got no foundation. That's the bottom line. So we have to distinguish between the deluded. If there's an unhappy feeling, if it's distressing and worrying and all that, that's because of the so we have to learn to hear the thought, ever more subtle, and argue with it. That's it. Okay, question.
I was going really well until you said, I heard to be happy for Trump.
Yeah, right.
No matter how long he haven't got there. And
No, not how he got there. The fact that he's got a lovely house. So, yeah, you know, if your beloved child finds a job, you're so happy for them, right?
Yes.
You're so glad and relieved they've got a lovely job and a lovely house. You're so pleased for them. I'm saying the same for the enemy. Be pleased he's got a lovely house. Just a lovely, everyone wants a lovely house. It's a simple thing. We're not discussing the methods we use. See, we're not discussing the methods you use to get there. Because that's what our wish, our happiness of somebody is contingent on if they deserve it. We want them to be perfect before we dare to love them. Very rude.
Can I, put that into, may their pleasure turn into the virtuous joy?
That's the next one. Just keep it simple first. There's levels of happiness that are more extensive and more marvelous. So, you see, in the whole process of cultivating bodhicitta, if you're familiar with these series, there's step by step. So the bare bones made you be happy at the most simple level, happy they've got a house, happy they've got good health, happy they've got money in the bank. The next level, finally, is to help if you can see that they're deluded and their methods are wrong, then you're broken-hearted for them because you know that they're causing themselves terrible future suffering. So then you hopefully find them, give them methods to get real happiness, but one humble step at a time. It's just learning to rejoice for people at the simplest level instead of all this judgment and, you know, do you understand?
Yeah.
And that's really tough. It's not easy because, we are resentful. If a person who's ugly gets happy, we want them to suffer. We hope his house burns down. Do you understand?
Yeah.
So this is, you see, we're not keep remembering, sweet pie. The hard part is, who do you think is the beneficiary of this practice of you in your chair? Only you. Mr. Trump has got nothing to do with this. You're using this visualization of a peanut to help your mind get humble and simply want him to be happy. There's nothing more than this for your benefit to open your little heart.
Yeah.
That's the point.
I get it.
You know what?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, oh, my God.
Come over here, Jean, and I'll, yeah. So we can hear.
Go, Sid. Talk your question, darling.
Well, just hang on a sec. Yep.
Okay, go for it.
Venerabina, you know the 7-point cause and effect, the Bodhi Chitta, I had to generate.
We need to speak more clearly because the sounding is kind of weird. Articulate your words, Sib.
The 7-point Bodhi Chitta, 7 cause and effect Bodhi Chitta, the first step, recognizing everyone as your mother. I can believe I
first.
Yeah, I saw that first part. Yeah. The second bit.
Of recognizing everyone as your mother.
Then.
So she can believe ...
I believe there's been this lifetime, and I believe I've had to have a lot of mothers to give me that, but I have trouble believing that everyone's been my mother because you can be born to the same bunch of mothers. I don't know how to have fixed my
This is just a technique. Based upon the idea that there are trillions of sentient beings, trillions of beginningless lifetimes, I think mathematically it's probably logical that we bump into them at least once as our mum. But the whole idea of it, darling girl, it's not a mathematical problem to solve. The whole idea is this extensiveness of billions of lifetimes and billions of sentient beings, and then using the mother as an example of a person, if it's a good relationship, where they nurture you and take care of you. So I think don't get too mathematical about it.
Okay.
Yes.
Good afternoon. Normally I'm a generally very happy person, always have been.
Good. You're very fortunate.
But when someone comes up to you and says, my mission is to make you unhappy, you're too happy, that's happened several times.
What do you mean by that? People say that to you?
I've had that.
They actually say those words.
I'm over 40, so in my over 40 years, I've had several people.
They actually say that to you?
My mission is to make you unhappy, you are too happy.
Well, they're sort of being sarcastic. They're friends or they're neighbours or they're strangers?
People that I know, acquaintances.
So they kind of get annoyed that you've been...
Even when you were at work, even colleagues,
So what do you do with that?
So, I mean, I feel compassion for people pretty much right away because I'm thinking, well, what's wrong? And I want to help them.
That's right.
But then they'll just throw it off. So it's like,
that's right.
Really help them. I'm like, sounds really twisted. I'm trying to help them. Okay, I get it. I don't understand why.
Well, okay. Well, first of all, you're a human being. That you got born from the second of conception in your mummy swallowing tube, your consciousness came from before, and you came programmed with your particular set of tendencies. So as you're establishing, and you're now 40-something, you've had a fairly happy disposition. That's a pretty incredible thing to be born with. You can see the world is full of very unhappy people. Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
And that's the fruit of dissatisfaction and anger. And so then if I don't know if you're a Buddhist, I have no idea, yes. But that would mean as a Buddhist, you'd be blissed out that you've worked so hard at practicing.
Is that okay? Is that right to be happy all the time?
No, you're not listening to me. I'll say it again. Forgive me.
Sorry.
But don't be sorry. The Buddhist view is your consciousness comes from before. I've no idea if you had that thought. I don't know. Yeah. Give me the Buddhist view. And you've had countless past lives. So at the time of your past death, a whole bunch of karmic seeds from your past practices manifest, all kind of get ready to ripen, and that produces this next package called
Onyx.
What's your name?
Onyx.
Oh, you're Onyx.
We met on Zoom.
Exactly. You're Onyx.
I asked
the question. Did Onyx. So this package that we label Onyx consists of the four main ways your past karma has run. One is you've got a human body. That's, first of all, like winning the lottery. You know, your virtue, your non-karmic, your non-killing, specifically non-killing karmic seed was triggered at the time you started the death process, about 7 weeks before you found your way to your mummy's womb. It's all very precise and laid out. Then at the same time, these other three tracks of karma, your three different bank vaults, the seeds that will produce your personality, the seeds that will produce your experiences at the hands of others, and the seeds which will produce even the way the physical environmental world impacts upon you. We are the creators of all of this. So all these karmic seeds grew to hang together, and then all the mind carrying these imprints ran like a magnet to Onyx's mummy's fallopian tube, and now here we have Onyx. So you're the fruit of your past actions. So you can establish in your life, since you're little, you can see that, you're telling us that you've managed to have a fairly, you're fairly happy, you've got happy feelings. So bad things have happened to you in your life?
Yes, many.
Right, and you've managed to navigate them. You've managed, you don't know why.
I understand.
So good. So you've managed to find a way to interpret it and to keep your male sustained in your kind of happy feelings and not
get no animosity.
I'm saying that means you don't have much anger.
So that's good. I feel sorry for them.
Exactly. That's fine. Shush, Onyx. I'm trying to tell you about it. You're too eager to tell someone. Shush, shush, shush. So you should be sober to stand. Yes, you must be happy for that reason. I mean, if you've just done a really good job and passed your music exam, grade one, you'd be happy for yourself. Well, if you come into this life with a bunch of positive qualities and have got a reasonable life and reasonable conditions and a reasonable body and reasonable friends and a reasonable environment, you won a lot, but you earned it. So you'd be, and the real point from that is, if you have the Buddhist analysis, don't just rest on your laurels. If you, like you're telling us about a garden full of veggies, basically, isn't it? You grew them all in the past, but you don't sit back in the laurels eating up all the veggies. You've got to keep growing more of them. So that means you've got to know what the causes of these happy feelings are and then the accumulation of your past virtuous actions. So be totally happy, but you've got ability to navigate the misery, navigate not to have anger. This is exactly the, but you've got far, the other one is you can rest on the laurels, but you know, because Buddhas were telling you that you've got far more potential. So you can just keep moving, utilizing this hard work you've done and keep moving. And then you'll have an understanding why other people get angry and upset and go crazy and depressed. And they have incredible compassion. Because many people are born with incredible tendency for suffering, incredible junkie mind. You can see this. Imagine being born with a tendency to want to jump on girls all day. Imagine wanting to torture all day. So like not like a miracle, but hard work. So you nourish this virtue and keep growing it. That's the real solution. Don't rest on your laurels.
Thank you, Barbara.
So you're very fortunate. And it's true, there are some people, I know a person, but do you help other people? Or you just sit there being happy?
Oh, I actually work with children.
Good.
When I can.
Perfect. And when you see the suffering, this is a good one to have. When you see suffering, do you have this thought, may they not suffer? May I do something to help? Do you have this wish?
We simply try to help them.
Good. So that's what grows the body sacrifice, is a strong aspiration every day. May I keep growing my wisdom so I can keep helping others. And you get braver and stronger.
That's what I'm trying to do.
Keep doing more. And you get more and more. Good. And you get learn the skills to do it.
Thank you.
Well done.
Thank you.
Now we can go. Now we can go home. Thank you, Petals. Thank you, Sue. You bring your question to think about your question, Petal. It was very confusing. And say it all tomorrow. Thank you, Deb, and Yvette, and Felicity, and Manny, and everybody, Carol, and Deb, everyone, and all you kind people here.
And thank you, Venerable Robina, for this
I'm wonderful. I'm doing my best to make you happy. Okay. Thank you, darling. Jamsu, Sentro, Nagoche, Maki, Panam, Eguchi, Kepanam, Pame, Payam, Pongne, Gonju, Kavashra. That means make compassion with amazing thoughts grow and grow and grow in the hearts of all. And remember, everything we've heard is volume. So nourish these seeds. Don't give up. That's the attitude. Thank you, people, so much. So kind.